The first sense of aesthetics is a philosophy which explains the conditions of any possible experience. So it means, very simply, what are the philosophical conditions by which I can see something, by which I can hear something, by which I can have a sense experience. And this is the topic of Kant's first critique, the critique of pure reason. The second sense in which we can understand aesthetics is what are the conditions by which I find something beautiful, by which an object of sense experience gives me pleasure, which for Kant is something that is beautiful, or something which gives me displeasure, or something which gives me a kind of a pain. This is a slightly more complicated concept for Kant because there are various different ways that I can experience something which is not pleasure in the face of a sense experience or in the face of an, let's say, aesthetic object. This is the topic of the third critique, the critique of judgment. I'm going to talk about both of these aspects of aesthetics today, and then next week I'm going to talk more or less only about this idea of the sublime, which is very important for Kant, but which is also absolutely crucial if we are to understand the way that Deleuze thinks about art. There is also, of course, the second critique, the critique of practical reason, which I'm probably not going to talk about today. We'll see how much time we have. The second critique is not really specifically useful for us in thinking about Deleuze and art, so for that reason I'm just going to leave it aside. But if you have questions and if there is time to talk about it today, then I'll see if I can say something about it. Last week I talked a little bit about, let's say, Deleuze's method, the way that Deleuze reads other philosophers. And I talked a little bit about how Kant is a kind of an unusual philosopher for Deleuze, because Deleuze is not, let's say, a friend of Kant. He regards Kant as an enemy, in fact. But nevertheless, he not only writes a book about Kant, but that many of Kant's concepts and ideas are going to be very important for Deleuze, even if they're important in the way that Deleuze, let's say, perverts them or goes against them. And I'm going to try and talk a little bit more about that today. But what it's also important to remember is that Kant's writing about aesthetics is not just really important for philosophy of aesthetics, but it basically creates the philosophy of aesthetics. So Kant is more or less the beginning and, let's say, the first reference for any philosophical discussion of aesthetics. So in a way, Deleuze is, let's say, taking a very classical approach by beginning with Kant's aesthetics for his own, or let's say, for building his own theory of art and his own theory of aesthetics. And as I tried to suggest last week, this is very typical for Deleuze's relationship to his philosophical forebears, in as much as Deleuze is a classical philosopher, in as much as he's completely engaged with the tradition and history of philosophy. But nevertheless, for Deleuze, the purpose of philosophy is not to simply repeat what has gone before, but to repeat what has gone before with a difference. One of Deleuze's most famous books, Difference and Repetition. So the idea is not to break with philosophy in the sense that you start doing something which is not philosophy, but that the purpose of philosophy, the, let's say, aim of philosophy, is to recreate philosophy. Not to forget the tradition, but to reinvent the tradition and to make it into something new. This is the sense in which tradition is not dead, but tradition is actually alive, because tradition is always able to produce itself in a new way. And this is, I think, very clear in Deleuze's relationship to Kant. It's another reason why it's a very good place for us to start with Deleuze, because we not only see this foundation of his theory of art, but we also see this method by which Deleuze does philosophy. Alright, so I'm going to start by talking about the Critique of Pure Reason. I'm just going to try and give you a kind of a crazy fast forward through the first critique. I apologize in advance if it's a little bit confusing, but I don't think it really matters whether you read Kant fast or slow, it's still confusing. So we won't worry about it too much. If you have a question, please just raise your hand, interrupt me, whatever, it's no problem. Alright, the Critique of Pure Reason. I also apologize for those of you who have done a course on Kant before, because this is going to be a kind of a boring repetition, but we have to start somewhere. The Critique of Pure Reason, it has two parts. The first part is called the analytic, and the second part is called the dialectic. I'm going to talk mostly about the first part today, the analytic, which is more or less the part that Deleuze is going to be interested in and that is going to be useful for us as we go on. The analytic, the first part of the Critique of Pure Reason, itself has two parts, and these are the subjective and the objective deductions. The subjective deduction gives us the theory of the understanding and explains how this works in order for a synthetic judgment to be possible. Now, a judgment, and this is going to be very important when we come to talk about the third critique, the critique of judgment. A judgment thinks the particular as this particular is contained within a universal. So it tries to explain a particular thing in terms of something that is universal. And a synthetic judgment is a judgment which combines a subject and a predicate. For example, the rose is red. Yeah? The rose is the subject, the predicate is red. And so a synthetic judgment allows us to make a judgment about, let's say, the qualities of a thing. The rose is red is actually, surprisingly enough, a very philosophical concept, because once you start reading different philosophers, you will be surprised, perhaps, as I am always surprised, how often the question of red comes up in philosophy. It's pretty amazing, actually. And the rose is red is also, of course, one of the first examples that gets discussed whenever a philosopher talks about redness. We might come back to this, because some of the philosophers that I'm going to talk about later on also try to understand what a philosophy of red might be. But anyway, that's for later. I always wanted to do a course about red, actually. I think that would be a really, that would be a good philosophy course. Anyway, okay. Okay, so the subject of deduction shows how this judgment, the rose is red, is possible. How is it possible to make this judgment? By relating the particular experience of the rose to a universal, but nevertheless, to the universal, but nevertheless, subjective conditions found within the understanding that give the conditions for the judgment's truth. So in other words, how is it possible to connect the particular experience of a rose with a universal concept of the type red? So how is it possible for us to make this kind of intellectual leap? The object of deduction, on the other hand, establishes what must be true a priori in order for an intuition or experience, for example, this experience of the rose, to exist as such. So how is it then? The subject of deduction is going to show us how we connect a particular experience to a universal category or a universal concept, and the object of deduction is going to show us how we actually have this experience in the first place. Okay, these are the two sides of the analytic, the first part of the critique of pure reason. Now, the subject of deduction shows that there are two sources of knowledge, two sources of the synthetic judgment. One is sensibility, and the other one is understanding. The first, sensibility, is the faculty of intuitions, of sense experience, and the second is the faculty of concepts or of the understanding. The first, the faculty of sense experience, is a passive faculty, yeah? And the second is an active faculty. We'll see what that means as we go along. Both of these faculties are required for us to know something. So, intuition is the faculty of the senses. It is through intuition that we have a sense experience. Yeah? We see something, we hear something, we smell something, and so on and so forth. But this sensation is not yet, let's say, an experience of an object. It is just, let's say, a raw sense experience. Yeah. We experience a colour, we see a shape, we hear a noise, but there remains, Kant says, still certain operations that have to happen in order for these experiences to, let's say, be transformed into an object. Yeah. And these transformations, or what Kant is going to call syntheses, are performed by the faculty of the imagination. The imagination synthesizes sensation according to certain fundamental operations that give these sense perceptions a cohesion that allow them to be understood by us as an object. So, I see some colours and some shapes, but something actually has to happen to those sense perceptions for them to be turned into a chair. Yeah? And these syntheses, as Kant calls them, there are two of them. The first one is what he calls apprehension, which means that I am able to experience parts of an object in succession. So if I look at a very big thing, I can't experience the whole object at the same time, I have to be able to see parts of it in succession. You know, I have to be able to synthesize these different experiences, yeah, in a succession, one after another. And the second synthesis is what he calls reproduction, which means that I have to remember the bits of the experience that I had before when I have the succeeding ones in order to keep them all in a kind of a single mass which is going to form the object. Yeah? So these are the two syntheses of the imagination, apprehension, and reproduction. Now, after the syntheses of apprehension and reproduction, which together, these are the operations of the imagination, and together these syntheses form what Kant calls a reproduction. Yeah? Sorry, not a reproduction, a representation. That is an object that is located in time and space. This time and space is going to be important. I'm going to get to that in a sec. After these two syntheses of the imagination, a further operation is required, Kant says, in order for, let's say, an object to appear. In order for the object to appear as what he calls an object of thought, as something that I can think about. And this final operation is an operation which is done not by the imagination, but by the understanding. And it's what Kant calls this operation recognition. This is the operation by which a representation, that is, a sensation which is organized by the syntheses of the imagination, is linked to consciousness, is linked to a thinking subject, the thinking subject that has the representation. And this requires a synthesis by which experience is connected to a concept of an object in general. The concept of an object, and Kant gives it a very famous formula, which is object equals X. It's not any object in particular, but it is the concept of an object which I need to have if I am to be able to think my experience. Yeah? If this experience is to, let's say, appear within my consciousness, within my thinking processes. So this is no longer a synthesis of sense experience that I receive from something out there. I'll talk more about this something out there a little bit later because it's also very important. But the imagination, the syntheses of the imagination are passive because I receive this sense experience. Yeah? But the operation of the understanding is active because it, let's say, applies this concept of an object in general, an object equals X. Yeah? It applies that concept to the synthesized experience of the imagination in order to produce an object within my consciousness. So Kant argues that in having a thought, and hence in being self-conscious, I necessarily think the object in general to which I relate the diversity of sense experience. This form, and it is a form, it's a kind of formalism, to use an aesthetic term, we'll come back to this when I talk about the third critique. This form, object equals X, comes from the understanding, not from the imagination, and as a result of this form being applied to my sense experience, the object conforms to the a priori concepts or principles of the understanding that Kant calls the categories, which are, he says, the forms of thought. So it is this object equals X which is able to turn sense experience into an object of thought. And once it is an object of thought, it must come under and be understandable according to these various categories or forms of thought. There are, he also calls these categories universal predicates. It means that they describe the object in a kind of universal sense, that every object that appears within my consciousness must appear according to these predicates, these universal predicates. There are four of them: quantity, quality, relation, and modality. Now, quality and quantity are reasonably self-evident. Relation, there are three, but anyway, to give you an idea, they include cause and effect. So you see, this is a very universal concept, cause and effect, and it means that any object that appears within my consciousness is subject to this universal category of cause and effect. So if it is an object, it must be subject to cause and effect. There must be cause and effect. And modality includes the possible, the existing, and the necessary. So again, these are very general, universal concepts which apply to any given object. Any specific object can be, and in fact must be, understood according to these universal categories. These categories give the conceptual conditions of any possible experience. So it means that for an object to exist, it means to exist in my consciousness, because in the end, for Kant, that's the only thing that we are actually able to know anything about. In order for it to exist in my consciousness, in order for an object to be an object of possible experience, it must conform to these categories of thought. This means the understanding, working with the imagination, determine phenomena rather than the objects themselves, that is, whatever it is that is out there, without these objects themselves determining my experience. Now, you remember last week I read a quotation from Deleuze where he expressed it in this way, that with Kant, it's such a revolution in philosophy because suddenly with Kant, I make the rules. Yeah? So with Kant, what appears, what exists, is something which is determined by the imagination and the understanding, that is, by mechanisms of perception and thought which exist within me. So when I see the chair, that chair is determined by these faculties that exist within my senses and my thought. That chair, that there is something there, but what it is actually in itself, well, we can't know that, yeah, because our knowledge and our imagination, these are the conditions of any possible experience. So when we have this experience, if we want to think about the universal truth of that experience, we cannot say anything about the object itself. We can only say something about the conditions under which that object appears within my consciousness. Okay, so having gone through all of this, Kant says the problem now is how, this is a quotation from Critique of Pure Reason, is how subjective conditions of thought can have objective reality. So, in other words, how is it possible that these conditions of experience and thought can actually appear, let's say, in the world, or can determine something as appearing in the world. As a result of this problem, an objective deduction is required to establish the validity of the categories inasmuch as they apply to objects. To achieve this, Kant shows how any representation assumes the existence of space and time. Space and time, he says, are the forms of appearing. It is therefore through space and time that an experience can be related to this object equals X. If there was no space and time, none of the operations of the imagination or the understanding would be able to take place. Okay, so how does this work? First, given the fact that I think, which Kant takes for granted, everything that is thought appears within the inner sense of time. Time, Kant argues, is the unchanging form of interiority within which things or representations move and change. In other words, what he's saying is, I have an experience, it's conditioned by the categories and so forth and so on and the understanding. But this experience, let's say, given that the experience involves some kind of change, implies that there is time within which this change occurs. And what this means is that there is a kind of a split between that part of myself which is in time and which changes as my experiences change, and a transcendental and unchanging part of myself which provides my changing experience with the form of time within which it can change. Slightly kind of difficult concept. You have to think that everything is going on inside my consciousness. Okay, for Kant, we can't know anything about what's really, really happening out there. Yeah? All we can know about is what's happening in here. And what's happening in here is that I'm having various sense perceptions, experiences, I'm seeing things, hearing things, and so forth and so on. I, through the processes of the imagination and the understanding, I identify these sense experiences with objects, with events that happen, and so forth and so on, with changes that's going on between these objects, etc., etc. But these changes, yeah, how do they happen? I mean, what is it that enables me to experience an object as changing? And he says, well, in order for me to experience an object that is changing, then there must be time. So time is also part of my consciousness, part of my thinking processes. But time in itself does not change. Time is a kind of a form within which change happens. But this is all inside of me. So myself as a subject is kind of always in this position of being split between that part which is changing, my experiences, my thoughts, and so forth and so on, and this other part which is like the frame or the condition of possibility for something to change in the first place. And this is time. This is time as the unchanging form of what changes. And this unchanging form is transcendental because it exists in the same way for everybody. Yeah? So my experiences and my thoughts, they are, let's say, my own, that they are unique to me. They depend on my point of view and my background and so forth and so on. But the frame within which those thoughts and experiences occurs, that is time itself, that is unchanging. That is the same for everybody, yeah? No matter what. So Deleuze is very interested in this point, and he's going to investigate it and use it in various ways, especially in difference and repetition. I'm not going to talk too much about that. If you're interested, go and have a look at difference and repetition. But he says that this element of time establishes for Kant, and here he uses a very famous phrase of the French poet Rimbaud. He says it means that I is another. I is another. Who I am myself is always, let's say, a split person. I'm always my own experiences and thoughts that I have, but at the same time, I'm also this unchanging form, which is not really, let's say, myself, in the way that I think of myself as being this person, my experiences and so forth, but I am also this kind of subjective form of time. I is another, inasmuch as there is a fundamental, but nevertheless internal difference that constitutes the self between the subject who experiences and acts in time and the form of time within which this experience and action takes place. This, Deleuze says, gives it's a quotation from Kant's Critical Philosophy, the small book about Kant. It says this gives a giddiness, an oscillation, which constitutes time. Now, Deleuze is, you know, Deleuze writes a lot about time, and we're going to come back to this when I talk about the books on the cinema, because the books on the cinema, they are about cinema, but in a philosophical sense, these are books about time. And all of this is going to become important again. But the thing that Deleuze likes about this theory of time that he finds in Kant is, again, typically Deleuzian, that in this theory of time that Kant provides, he says, Deleuze says, quoting Hamlet this time, time is out of joint. That previously in philosophy, time had always been understood as the measurement of a movement. But with Kant, time becomes this transcendental condition of thought, this kind of necessary split in the subject itself. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Okay, the other aspect of the objective deduction establishes space as the outer sense by which the appearances of the world are organized. And this is the form by which I understand there to be something exterior to me which affects me. So, like, just as time was the form within which something changes, so space is the form of experience by which something, I'm able to locate something as being outside of me and in relationship to me. It's not a personal experience, but it is the condition of me having a personal experience. So space and time are not a priori concepts in the way that the categories are, because concepts have a plurality of examples and are generated subjectively. It means cause and effect. Cause and effect is something which has a has an infinity of examples, yeah, that it operates through. But space and time are, Kant says, a priori intuitions. They are the forms of intuition, yeah, and they are the conditions of possibility of experience in terms of intuition, rather than the conditions of possibility of, let's say, consciousness or thought. So on the one side, we have the subjective conditions for experience and knowledge, the syntheses of the intuitions, of the intuition, and the categories of the understanding. And on the other, we have the objective conditions of experience, which are space and time, without which no concept, no intuition could even occur in the first place. So as a result, what Kant calls objective knowledge, a priori synthetic judgments, has a double origin, first in the sensibility, then in the understanding, and these two faculties, the imagination and the understanding, they are in harmony, they work together. This harmony is going to be very important. In effect, what's going to happen is that there is not only a harmony between understanding and imagination in relation to the conditions of experience, there is another harmony that operates between reason and the understanding in relationship to moral action or to desire, which is the subject of the second critique. And this is precisely what Kant is going to realize later on in his life, is that he never really managed to explain why these faculties were in harmony. What was the cause of this harmony? It's never really explained in the first two critiques, and that's why he's going to end up writing the third critique as a way of trying to explain why the faculties are working together. I'll talk more about that when I come to the third critique. Okay, so with this very brief sketch, we can see the sense in which Kant's philosophy is a transcendental philosophy, yeah? Because these conditions of possibility for experience, the conditions of any possible experience, they are transcendental in the sense that they are, that everybody who has a perception, everybody who has a thought, must have, according to Kant, these faculties, the faculty of the imagination and the faculty of the understanding. They are transcendental, they are shared by everybody. But they are not exactly transcendent, which is a term which would apply to the ideas, or in a more normal sense or everyday sense, for example, the Christian idea of God. God exists outside the world and determines what happens in the world. Now, the transcendental faculties of imagination and understanding do not exist outside of the world. They exist within us, within the processes of experience and thought. So they are not outside of the world. Yeah? But at the same time, they are not, let's say, purely subjective, because they are the same for everybody. Yeah? That means anybody who has a perception, anybody who has a thought, must have these transcendental faculties in order to have an experience or to have a thought. So we could say that these faculties form a kind of transcendental subjectivity. That is, they are subjective. They are within each person, thinking person. But at the same time, they are not personal. They are not determined, or even they don't even have anything to do with,
yeah,
my personality, who or what I am. They exist completely apart from who or what I am. They are instead the conditions for who or what I am. As a perceiving, thinking being, I require these faculties within me, not without, not outside of me, but inside. Now, Deleuze, in general, as a philosopher, is very interested in the transcendental. But it's a transcendental that is without a subject. So Deleuze is interested, he sees the task of philosophy as being understanding what those transcendental conditions of thought and experience might be. But he breaks with Kant on this point, which is that he doesn't see those conditions as being subjective or human in the way that the usual tradition of philosophy would have. So as we will see when we move on to Nietzsche, Nietzsche takes a very fundamental place in Deleuze's philosophical thinking, because it is Nietzsche who is also interested in trying to think this transcendental level, this level of the conditions of existence, but to separate these transcendental conditions from any kind of human subjectivity. So Deleuze is interested in transcendental conditions, but without a subject, without a transcendental subject, and without the universal applicability of conditions of possible experience. That is, without this common sense, which is what Kant finds in the faculties. In other words, whatever the conditions are for, let's say, existence, these conditions for Deleuze are transcendental. That is, they apply in every instance. Yeah? But these conditions cannot be thought in terms of human subjectivity. So in other words, they are not located within, let's say, or as a framework of human consciousness. There's something else. Deleuze is going to call them inorganic life. He's going to call it maybe his animal is going to be very important. It's going to be a much more expansive idea of what transcendental conditions are. It's not going to be limited to a kind of humanity. So Deleuze is going to use a whole variety of different terms to try to get at what this transcendental realm is. The terms are going to change with almost every book, with each thinker that he is dealing with, and so forth and so on. What is that strange noise? And some of these terms are going to be the plane of immanence, the plane of consistency, the body without organs. For Guattari, it's going to be the ethico-aesthetic paradigm, etc., etc., etc. Fundamentally, this transcendental level, which is, let's say, immanent to everything that is going to be, for Deleuze, first of all, defined by difference, not by identity. So it's always whatever it is which is going to condition existence. It's not going to be an identity. It's not going to be something which defines what something is. It's going to be something which defines how something changes, yeah, how something becomes. And it's also not going to define the conditions of possible experience, which is what Kant is looking for. That means that whatever these transcendental conditions are, they are not going to, let's say, pre-exist what is in the way that Kant has it, but they are going to be, instead of conditions of possible experience, they're going to be what Deleuze calls the conditions of real experience. In other words, we're not going to have a framework, a transcendental framework, through which any experience whatsoever comes to be an experience or to be a thought. We're going to have a real experience, and its conditions are going to be unique and particular to that experience. Deleuze takes the term conditions of real experience from a contemporary of Kant who wrote a very influential critique of Kant's first critique. His name is Salomon Maimon, and Deleuze is very interested in Maimon's critique of Kant, and I'm going to talk in more detail about Deleuze and Maimon in the lecture about Nietzsche that comes in a couple of weeks. This is also going to be important when I come to speak about phenomenology, because it's precisely on this point that Deleuze is going to critique phenomenology. Now, again, Deleuze has a kind of ambiguous relationship to phenomenology. Phenomenology is, let's say, the dominant philosophical movement at the time of Deleuze's formation, in the 40s and the 50s, and then in the 60s in France. So Deleuze is very close to phenomenology in many ways, but he is also breaking with phenomenology, and this is going to be one of the most important places where he breaks with phenomenology. He's going to claim that phenomenology is basically a kind of a contemporary form of Kantianism, because in the end, even right up to the very end of Merleau-Ponty and his increasingly complicated and sophisticated attempts to merge the subject and the object, nevertheless, through all of that, he finally only manages to produce another kind of transcendental subjectivity. He does not manage to escape, the phenomenology itself does not manage to escape a basic kind of condition of humanity. This is going to mark a certain line that will distinguish Deleuze from phenomenology. So these are all things that we're going to come back to as we go along. All right, so in summary then, we can look at the first quotation on the page that I gave out. This comes from Deleuze's first seminar on Kant. If you don't have one, maybe people could pass a couple back and share, if you're feeling generous, communist in spirit. Good, excellent. All right. It's when I say, this is Deleuze on Kant, it's when I say that every phenomenon refers to the conditions of the appearing of the phenomenon, in this very statement, I am saying that these conditions belong to the being whom the phenomenon appears, to whom the phenomenon appears. In other words, the subject is constitutive. And understand this well, otherwise it's a radical misinterpretation. The subject is constitutive not of the phenomenon, in other words, it's not exactly a hallucination. It is not constitutive of what appears, but it is constitutive of the conditions under which what appears to it appears to it. This is a very important point. Kant is not trying to say that, you know, we're just making everything up. Yeah? There's just, we're living, it's not a solipsism. Yeah? It's not that we are completely trapped within a kind of a self-referring system that that we're just, you know, that what we see has, you know, cannot be proven or understood apart from our own perception and so forth and so on. That's why imagination is very important, because it's through imagination that we do have contact with something out there. Yeah? We receive these experiences, these sense perceptions from something. Now, we don't hallucinate. It's an interesting point, because hallucination is going to be quite an important element of Deleuze's theory about art. And he's going to use the word vision, which in English has a nice kind of double meaning between what we see, but also our vision, which is something that we hallucinate. So for Deleuze, art is always going to involve a kind of a vision, which is going to be kind of playing with this certain undecidable element. It's going to be part perception and part hallucination. Anyway, we'll talk much more about that. The point is then that it's not that we're just all living inside our own kind of cinemas and we're just, you know, making it up as we go along. We are getting something from outside. But whatever it is that we get from outside, it has to travel through the conditions of experience in order for us to make any sense of it, yeah? Which basically means that we only experience what Kant calls phenomena, and we can never experience the so-called thing in itself, which Kant calls a noumena. Yeah? So there is a kind of a break, which is not a break with the outside world. We can know nothing of the outside world, but there must be an outside world in order for us to know something in the first place. Yeah? So, okay. So this is a very radical rearrangement of things, because phenomena are no longer the appearance of things, at least not in any sense that we can determine. Rather, phenomena are representations of things that we cannot know. As a result, we can have knowledge, a priori knowledge, but this is not knowledge about things in the world, or things in themselves, or even of things as they appear to us, but it is only knowledge of the conditions under which a thing appears. These transcendental conditions under which a thing appears. This we can know. We can know for sure, according to Kant. We can know this. This is knowledge. We know this. This is true. But this is not a truth or knowledge which applies to anything outside of my own experience or my own thoughts and consciousness. This, of course, is hugely influential in the history of philosophy. If you think, for example, maybe some of you have read some Derrida, you have Derrida's famous statement from Off-Grammatology, there is nothing outside of the text. Many people would argue this is a kind of, you know, Kantianism run through literary theory. So the kind of repetitions of this Kantian revolution have continued and will continue to continue beyond today. Alright, so we can't know anything about things in themselves, or the noumena, through the understanding. The understanding only gives us the conditions by which we can know something, or we can think something. But we have another faculty, and that is reason. And reason is a faculty which is seeking things in themselves. Reason wants to go beyond the understanding, beyond the imagination, in order to find something which exists in itself. Something that exists beyond the limits of experience and of understanding. So reason is a faculty which attempts to find transcendent ideas that represent the totality of conditions under which a category of relation may be attributed to objects of possible experience. Ideas, therefore, represent something unconditioned, so something that goes beyond the limits of experience and knowledge. Things like the soul, nature in itself, and God. These are ideas which Kant says ground the categories of quantity, quality, relation, and modality. They offer the kind of, let's say, the ground of these categories. But these things, like the soul, nature in itself, and God, these things cannot be objects of experience. They cannot be objects of experience, obviously. God, the totality of nature, the soul, we cannot perceive these things. Neither, Kant says, can we understand these things according to the framework provided by the understanding. So we need reason, this is anyway reason's function, to be able to, let's say, grasp these transcendent, this time, transcendent, they are outside of the world, these things, to grasp these transcendent grounds to our faculties, or to the faculties of the understanding and the imagination. I'm going to read out a long passage now from the Critique of Pure Reason. It's the next one on the page that I've given you, which is where Kant explains the function of reason. He writes, "Now the transcendental concept of reason is directed always solely towards absolute totality in the synthesis of conditions, and never terminates save in what is absolutely, that is, in all relations, unconditioned. For pure reason leaves everything to the understanding alone applying immediately to the objects of intuition, or rather to their synthesis in the imagination." So reason leaves, you know, let's say the day-to-day running of the human brain to the understanding and to the imagination. Reason concerns itself exclusively with absolute totality in the employment of the concepts of the understanding and endeavours to carry the synthetic unity, which is thought in the category, up to the completely unconditioned. In other words, it tries to find the ground for these categories. We may call this unity of appearances the unity of reason, and that expressed by the category, the unity of the understanding. Reason accordingly occupies itself solely with the employment of understanding, not indeed insofar as the latter contains the ground of possible experience, for the concept of the absolute totality of conditions is not applicable in any experience, since no experience is unconditioned, but solely in order to prescribe to the understanding its direction towards a certain unity of which it has itself no concept. And in such manner as to unite all the acts of the understanding in respect of every object into an absolute whole. The objective employment of the pure concepts of reason is, therefore, always transcendent, while that of the pure concepts of understanding must, in accordance with their nature, and inasmuch as their application is solely to possible experience, be always immanent. So understanding the conditions of possible experience found in the understanding is always immanent to experience or to consciousness, whereas the function of reason is to, let's say, take us out of these conditions in order to understand the unconditioned grounds of those experiences. Yeah? That cannot be found in the understanding, because the understanding only provides the conditions of possible experience. It wants to reason instead, wants to find these transcendent ideas, which are themselves the base of the conditions of possible experience. The soul, God, nature in its entirety, so on. I understand by idea a necessary concept of reason to which no corresponding object can be given in sense experience. Thus, the pure concepts of reason, now under consideration, are transcendental ideas. They are concepts of pure reason in that they view all knowledge gained in experience as being determined through an absolute totality of conditions. They are not arbitrarily invented. They are imposed by the very nature of reason itself, and therefore stand in necessary relation to the whole employment of understanding. Finally, they are transcendent and overstep the limits of all experience. No object adequate to the transcendental idea can ever be found within experience. One of the reasons that Kant needs reason and the ideas that reason discovers is that if I make the rules in relationship to my experience, well, it starts to mean that it's a little bit problematic to understand where God might fit into this. So Kant has to find a way which will allow him to put, let's say, God and also morality back into the system, because it seems as if we just look at his account of the imagination and the understanding, it seems as if somehow, you know, everything now has come into the human, that knowledge, experience, everything is determined from within the human being. Yeah? And Kant has this problem then of saying, well, how can we not just show, but understand and in fact prove that God remains, let's say, the basis of everything that has happened and everything that does happen. But obviously, God can't appear within the faculties of the imagination or the understanding, because these are the conditions of human experience, so that they cannot define God. The conditions of human experience cannot define God. God must exist outside of those conditions, but God must also, let's say, be connected to those conditions. Can't just have God kind of floating around somewhere out there, you know, without actually playing a necessary and important role within what happens. So reason is the faculty which, let's say, discovers these transcendent ideas as the ground for its own operations. Reason is crucial. Reason is the faculty which is examined in the Critique of Practical Reason, the second critique. And in this critique, Kant, I've already mentioned, one of the categories, one of the subcategories, if you like, is cause and effect. And Kant has a kind of materialist idea about why things happen in the world. One thing causes another thing, and that causes another thing, and so on and so forth. But this presents a real problem, which is, what is the classic problem in the face of materialism? This is, okay, what about free will? Yeah? And if I don't have free will, what about morality? Yeah? How can I, you know, because if there is the right thing to do, yeah, if there is a good thing to do and a bad thing to do, well, if everything is just a kind of series of cause and effects, then how can I possibly be to blame if I do a bad thing? Yeah? If I don't have free will, if I can't choose to do something, then how can I actually be blamed for doing anything. So this is clearly a problem. It's a problem for Kant, but it's going to be a problem for lots of people, lots of philosophers, actually. That if you have a philosophy, a materialist philosophy, which explains the world in terms of cause and effect, then you have to say, well, where is the place for choosing the right thing to do? So the Critique of Practical Reason is going to be the way in which Kant is going to, let's say, reintroduce free will into a system. It's going to explain to us how it is possible for us to choose to do the right thing, even though it seems as if the world is determined according to a materialist model. Now, it's a kind of famously bizarre argument, because he's going to say that free will is actually the kind of, when we choose what is kind of necessary. So it's going to be a weird kind of way that he does it. I'm not going to go into too much detail with it because it's not super important for what we're really looking at in the class. So I leave that to a Kant specialist to explain to you. But reason nonetheless is important for the third critique, because the ideas are going to kind of come back again in the third critique and play an important role, especially in relationship to the sublime, which is an experience, which is an aesthetic experience, which is going to reveal to us these ideas. So it's going to be approached in the third critique from a different angle. Okay, so the idea, and this again is going to become important in relationship to the sublime, is a concept of a maximum and can never itself be found in the actual world. You cannot, let's say, find the totality of nature or God or the soul in the world. It's a concept of a maximum. The purpose of reason is to determine the reality of the idea given its empirical conditions. These conditions involve the absolute whole of all appearances, and as a result, they can only take the form of an idea because we can never represent them in a concept or in an image. As a result, Kant writes, the idea remains a problem to which there is no solution. And in fact, Deleuze is going to pick up on this description of the idea, and he's going to develop it in his own way, in Difference and Repetition, particularly, where he's going to talk about problematic ideas. And problematic ideas basically define the realm of what he calls, following Bergson, the virtual. So the virtual is, for Deleuze, the realm of problematic ideas, which means these problematic ideas are basically relations of difference that form series that are actualized in the world, but which themselves cannot be of the world. So they have a certain, let's say, echo with Kant's ideas, but they nevertheless are going to be very different from these ideas because they're going to have nothing to do with God and so forth and so on. They're going to be, let's say, the specific conditions of a real experience. The specific conditions of a real experience, in these terms, is an idea, which is a series or a related series of differences which are not actual, but which determine the actual, but which are also inseparable from the actual. Anyway, I'll talk more about that as we go along. Okay, so in both the first and the second critiques then, we have a relationship between the faculties of reason and the understanding, whereby they are performing different functions, but they are operating in harmony with each other. And it is this harmony, or as Kant calls it, a priori accord of the faculties, that defines what Kant calls common sense. Deleuze describes common sense like this. It's the next quotation on the page. Knowledge implies a common sense without which it would not be communicable and could not claim universality. Kant will never give up the subjective principle of a common sense of this type, that is to say, the idea of a nature of the faculties, of a healthy and upright nature, which allows them to harmonize with one another and to form harmonious proportions. This is another way that Deleuze parts company with Kant. And in Difference and Repetition, Deleuze claims that Kant's orientation, this is a quotation now from Difference and Repetition, Kant's orientation, this is the idea of the common sense, is a hindrance to philosophy because it can constitute only an ideal orthodoxy. Ideal, he means in terms of idealism. It's an orthodoxy, let's say, of the abstract. It's an orthodoxy of thought and experience in general. That is, conditions of possible experience. Whatever experience we have, whatever thought we have, there has to be this framework which conditions it. Yeah? Deleuze says it's a kind of orthodoxy, a kind of a doxa. You can't escape it. In order for there to be thought, there must be this structure. This runs against what Deleuze sees as philosophy's fundamental task, which is to break with orthodoxy and with doxa. This is what I mentioned at the beginning, that for Deleuze, philosophy is always practical, which is actually the name of one of his books, Practical Philosophy, that this means that it is always breaking with itself, that it is always producing itself new. That is any worthwhile philosophy. Yeah? Any worthwhile philosophy always attacks dogmatism and orthodoxy. So for him, this is really one of the most offensive parts of Kant's philosophy, that it establishes this kind of doxa for thought and as thought. So Deleuze will never stop objecting to Kant's common sense and the implicit moralism of placing harmony at the basis of human subjectivity. Of course, Deleuze finds this idea that it should be a harmony, should be the basis of understanding or experience. This is offensive to Deleuze. Deleuze always wants to put difference or the break, yeah, at the basis of whatever happens. For him, life is a process of differentiation, of making differences, of overcoming, if you want to use the Nietzschean term for it. Yeah, this process by which being is becoming, that by which change is the defining force of what is. Deleuze also points out that Kant assumes this harmony of the faculties and even shows how it works in different proportions in the first and second critiques, but he does not show where it comes from. I mentioned this before. Deleuze argues that in fact Kant requires a genetic theory of common sense. He needs a theory of where it came from, like what is the reason for this common sense. What is the reason for this harmony? And this is exactly what Kant is going to try and provide in the Third Critique, which he writes at the very end of his life. So for Deleuze, the first two critiques are completed only in the last critique. It's only in the Third Critique that we finally get around to, let's say, the kind of guts of the question, which is, what is actually the reason or the ground for this harmony of the faculties, for this common sense which defines the conditions of experience, which defines the transcendental subjectivity through which we experience and think. All right, are there any questions? Well, it's either really good because you understood it all, or it's really bad because it means you understood nothing. So we'll just hope that it was the first one and carry on. All right. So now I'm going to talk about the Third Critique for the rest of today, and then next week I'm going to talk about the Sublime, which is really, this is more or less all kind of background for trying to understand how the Sublime forms the kind of launching pad, if you like, for Deleuze's trajectory from, but also away from Kant in terms of aesthetic philosophy. So, the Third Critique, the Critique of Judgment. As I said before, the judgment, our judgment, is the ability to think the particular as contained under a universal. So we have a particular experience, and the question of judgment is, how can we understand this particular experience in terms of a universal category as its condition? Now, Kant says there are two types of judgment. The first is a determining judgment. And in a determining judgment, the universal is known and it is applied to something particular. So this would be more like the situation we had in the first critique, where we know the categories, and through the categories, we are able to understand any particular experience. But there is also another kind of judgment, which is called a reflective judgment. And a reflective judgment is where the particular is given, the experience is given, we have the experience, but the universal must be found. It's the universal. So in other words, we don't understand the particular through the universal. We have a particular, and through that particular, we must discover or find the universal. And here, the idea really appears in its nature as problem. In the determining judgment, the concept is given by the understanding, that's what we saw in the Critique of Pure Reason, or the idea is given by reason, that's what is discussed in the second critique, the Critique of Practical Reason. And the understanding, or reason, then determines the contributions of the other faculties. So this is the sense in which in the first two critiques, one faculty legislates for the others. So they all work together, but one of them is kind of the boss. So in the Critique of Pure Reason, it's the understanding, and the Critique of Practical Reason, it's reason. In a reflective judgment, nothing is given from the point of view of the faculties. What is given is simply a sensory experience and the feeling of pleasure or displeasure that it arouses. The faculty of judgment, therefore, doesn't give the universal conditions to which a kind of object must be subject. Rather, it gives the subjective and particular conditions for the exercise of the faculties. So in other words, with the critique of pure reason and the Critique of Practical Reason, Kant explains the universal conditions for an experience or for a thought or for a moral act, in the case of the second critique. Yeah? So he tells you, he shows what the conditions of possibility are for any particular experience or thought or any particular moral act. Yeah? So it's starting from the universal in order to understand the particular. But with the critique of judgment, we only have the particular, and it is only from this that we must discover, yeah, its condition. And it's not just that we must discover its condition, because this experience, this feeling that we have of pleasure or displeasure is going, in fact, Kant says, to give the condition for the exercise of the faculties. So this judgment is actually going to be the condition for the operation of the faculties as they are outlined in the other two critiques. So as a result, the faculty of judgment doesn't legislate on how the other faculties operate, as understanding does in the first critique and reason does in the second critique. In fact, it legislates only over itself. It's only concerned with its own operation. It does not have, let's say, control or the deciding vote in how the other faculties are going to work in relationship to it. That's going to be very important for the conclusion that Kant is going to draw here. So, in the third critique, Kant tries to discover the a priori laws of reflective judgment as the ground of the harmony or the common sense of the faculties that he established in the first two critiques. So Kant explains this. It's the next quotation on the sheet. It comes from the introduction of the third critique. He writes, "There must, after all, be a basis uniting the supersensible that underlies nature and the supersensible that the concept of freedom contains practically." These are the first and second critiques. "Even though the concept of this basis does not reach cognition of it either theoretically or practically," in other words, within the faculty of understanding or the faculty of reason, "and hence does not have a domain of its own, though it does make possible the transition from our way of thinking in terms of principles of nature to our way of thinking in terms of principles of freedom." So he's looking for this kind of hinge, this kind of common factor that is going to allow and explain the way that the faculty of the understanding and the faculty of reason are in harmony with each other, even though one is determining in either instance, in the instance of the operation of the understanding or pure reason, the operation of practical reason or reason itself. Okay, so judgment has both objective and subjective aspects, and the critique of judgment is divided accordingly into two halves. The first part concerns aesthetic judgment and subjective experience, while the second part is concerned with teleological judgment, or the way we judge things according to their ends. I'm going to mainly talk about the first part, because that's the part that Deleuze is mostly interested in. So the first part of the book is called The Critique of Aesthetic Judgment, and it discusses the four possible types of reflective judgment. These are the agreeable, the beautiful, the sublime, and the good. Remember, these are all about the pleasure or displeasure I feel when I have an experience. This is why it's something new. The understanding explained to us what by what conditions I could have an experience and by the conditions under which I could think. Second critique explained the conditions by which I could act, yeah, by which I could will something myself to do something in a free and moral way. And the third critique is concerned with the feeling, with what I feel when I have an experience, yeah, the pleasure or displeasure that I have. So these are four types of this kind of judgment, concerned mainly with the experience of pleasure: the agreeable, the beautiful, the sublime, and the good. Kant spends most time discussing the beautiful and the sublime because it is in these that we can discover how subjective judgments can attain universality from within the realm of the empirical. This is what the whole critique is trying to do. We remember that it's reflective judgment is when we have this particular, this experience of pleasure or displeasure, and how we can move from that to a universal, yeah, to an idea. Now, judgments about the agreeable never get beyond their subjective statement of liking, I like this, yeah? And judgments concerning the good are already determined by a transcendental moral law. So this is why Kant is going to spend most time on the beautiful and the sublime, so as Deleuze. So only in aesthetic judgments concerning the beauty or sublimity of nature can we momentarily stand outside of our own personal point of view, not in order to gain knowledge of the transcendental world, but to perceive the harmony between our faculties and the objects in relation to which they are employed. This is going to be the purpose of this critique, is to examine these kinds of feelings that we have when faced with the beautiful and the sublime, in order to understand how it is that our faculties can operate in this harmony. In fact, Kant is going to try and show how this harmony of the faculties in fact reflects a certain kind of divine order of ideas, which is what is going to make this harmony possible. So in the end, it's going to lead us to ideas, to the realm of ideas, but it's going to do so in a different way from the other critiques, because it's going to work through feeling. And it's also, let's say, along the way, going to explain how it is that the other critiques were able to do this as well. It's going to show the way in which this harmony between the faculties is possible in the first place. Kant begins from what he calls the purposiveness of nature. This is the assumption that our experience of nature, when he's talking about the sublime and the beautiful, he's mostly talking about experience of nature. Okay, so the purposiveness of nature is the assumption that our experience of nature in terms of pleasure or displeasure conforms to certain laws of reflection. It is that our experience of nature, our pleasurable or displeasurable experience of nature, reflects something about nature, something about the purposes, in fact, of nature. And it is precisely this reflection which is going to connect the empirical particularity of my pleasurable or displeasurable experience to an a priori necessity or idea, which is the totality of nature. So So Kant is going to use this feeling in order to show how it is that my experience, this particular thing, this experience that gives me pleasure, reflects a kind of the idea of the necessity of the totality of nature. That's going to be his kind of trajectory. Kant argues that this reflection can be seen, for example, in the way that nature appears to us within species, which are themselves grouped into genera, which are themselves grouped into larger generalities, and so on. So these a priori laws distinguishing living things into different branches concern the appearance of the totality of nature itself in our judgments, and so reveal the ways the rules of reflection are indeed those of nature. It is the appearance of nature that conforms to an idea of the organization of the totality of nature. However, these rules must be explained without recourse to the conditions of experience or those of moral action, and they have to be found within the process of judgment itself. Okay, so in sense experience there are, as we have seen, certain objective conditions of experience given by the imagination, as well as the purely subjective elements of pleasure or displeasure. In other words, we can't have a feeling without having a sense experience. So we need, let's say at the very least, the syntheses of the imagination in order to be able to have a feeling in the first place. We can't feel pleasure or displeasure unless we have something to feel it about, yet we have an experience to feel it about. Now, this subjective element of pleasure and displeasure, or sensations, these are what Kant calls aesthetic judgments. And these are not determined by the concepts of the understanding or by the ideas of reason. So this means that through aesthetic judgments, or sensation, we can discover the a priori rules or purposes of nature in its entirety, independently of their determination by understanding or reason. Now, aesthetic judgments are of the type, this gives me pleasure, or this gives me displeasure. But these remain purely subjective when they merely depend on my personal interests and tastes. So, for example, when I say smoking a cigar gives me pleasure, this is clearly not a statement about universal truth or a priori laws. So I need to go beyond my personal interests to find why a particular sensation of pleasure could be understood as being universal, could give a universal or a priori law. Kant argues that an object is beautiful rather than simply agreeable, because in it I sense the way nature operates by the same rules as my experience of it. This is what Kant calls a judgment of taste. This is beautiful. This is a universal or a priori judgment, because the feeling of pleasure, the sensation it names, is not determined by a concept nor by an idea, but nevertheless has what Kant calls a form of finality. This means that the beautiful thing appears to have been designed with a purpose, even though it does not have any practical function. So this is now beginning to describe a work of art. So we experience a work of art, we say this is beautiful. Now when we say this, what we mean is, first of all, not just I like it, it's a statement of universality. It's universal truth. This is beautiful. Yeah? We'll talk more about that. But the reason that we say that we can maintain that the beauty of this thing is universal is because it appears to have been designed with a purpose. With what purpose? With the purpose it reflects. It reflects this purpose of nature in its totality. It shows us, let's say, the organization of nature in itself. Yeah? It gives us an idea of nature's purposiveness, as Kant calls it. So this purpose, yeah, it's not a practical function. It's a purpose which makes it part of this totality of nature and which is reflected in the beauty of the object, a beauty that is only accessible to me, not through reason or through the understanding, but through the faculty of judgment, yeah? The faculty of feeling. So as a result, beauty has nothing to do with the interest of the observer, because the beauty of the object is not a means to a subjective end. That is, it's nothing about our desires, which could never be universal. It's nothing about what I like, yeah? Because that I could never draw any kind of universal conclusion from just simply something that I like. Yeah? It has to be more than that. So it's not to do with the interest of the viewer or of the observer. And this leads Kant to the rather odd claim that in a judgment of taste, this is a quotation now, we must not be the least bit biased in favour of the thing's existence, but must be wholly indifferent about it. So what is agreeable to me, what I like, that is something subjective. That is about my personal likes and dislikes. But what is beautiful is something that I must be personally completely indifferent to. It's nothing to do with what I like or don't like, because it's about a universality. It's about the universality of this feeling of pleasure, which is a reflection of this idea of the purposes of the totality of nature. It means that what we sense as beautiful gives pleasure because of its objective form, which reveals the universal purposes of nature. Again, it's a kind of formalism. It's about its design. I talked a little bit about this last week, this ongoing debate in art history between design and colour. So Kant at this stage is very much on the side of design. It's about the design of the thing is what reflects the design of nature, to put it that way. It's not about the feeling of pleasure, which is a disinterested feeling, yeah, is a feeling provoked by the design of the object. Okay, so what we sense as beautiful gives pleasure because of its objective form, which reveals the universal purposes of nature. So how does this happen? The pleasure I experience in the beautiful reveals the harmony of my and everybody else's faculties in its presentation. This harmony is the harmony of nature, and so in this way, a particular sensation, pleasure, reveals the universal idea of the purposiveness of nature, of the purposes of nature. This is an aesthetic rather than a logical universality, because it doesn't rest on concepts as its conditions of possibility, but on a subjective, but nevertheless universal feeling. As a result, aesthetic judgments always concern a particular object and are not concepts of the understanding that are logically deduced and then applied to all objects. But at the same time, aesthetic judgments are not about the object as such, but about the universal subjective conditions of such a judgment. These universal conditions are, Kant claims, the free play of the faculties, and it is this free play which gives us pleasure. What's the time? 55. All right, well then I'll leave it there and I'll pick it up again next week.